Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. With The Blazing World, author Siri Husvet returns to the New York art world, telling the story of the artist Harriet Burton. After years of watching her work ignored or dismissed by critics, Burton conducts an experiment she calls maskings. She presents her own art behind three male masks, concealing her female identity. Author of novels, a memoir, and several collections of essays, Husvet has written extensively about the art world, including her novel, What I Loved, and her essays on painting, Mysteries of the Rectangle. Again, the new novel is The Blazing World, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Siri Husvet to this week's book show. What a delight.
Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Thank you very much for taking the time. What brought you, in some ways, back to the art world, but ultimately to this idea of exploring gender, and especially through that lens of the art world?
Well, I'm deeply interested in the visual image, and I have before created artworks inside novels. So I suppose the artworks that I've created are in some way conceptual works of art. And I think that the visual can do what the verbal doesn't do often. In other words, that sometimes presenting the work of an artist, even if you do it verbally, you get access to the inner life of that artist in ways that storytelling can't always do.
And the way you chose to do that in this novel is through pieces and through fragments, if you will, to tell the ultimate story. It is not a straightforward narrative.
Yes, the idea of masks, I think, came first. As you know, in a classical theater, a mask is not something that the character hides behind, but becomes a form of revelation. So I was thinking of masks both as disguise and as a mode of opening aspects of this character, Harriet Burton's personality, that she was unaware of before. The fragmentary form really came to me as a way for the reader to engage in the thematics of the book itself, so that every person who speaks in this book, including the main character who speaks in her diaries, but also her lover, her children, and various other people who do not know Harriet Burton very well, have very different points of view on who this person is, what the project meant. And I wanted those clashing views to make it in some way impossible for the reader to rest inside a single perspective.
When you create those perspectives and those reactions, if you will, does that come right after you write and say, okay, this is what Harriet is going to do, and then this is going to be the reaction, or do they come in all different times?
Well, I wrote the book in sequence, and I did feel as I was writing the book that this was something like having multiple personality disorder. In other words, I know that they're characters, but I really deeply inhabited the voices of these different people, so that when I was writing as Harriet's lover, a man I fell in love with, Bruno Kleinfeld. Mm-hmm. Bruno's point of view is quite different from Harriet's, and he has certain sexist tendencies, for example, but I find him very dear. And while I was Bruno, I embodied those beliefs as much as the beliefs I had when I was writing as Harriet.
When you look at the overall idea behind the book of, as you say, when you came to this idea of masks, what brings Harriet to this idea of taking on a male form to present her art?
Well, Harry, also known as Harriet, who's also known as Harry, is very deeply interested in the drama of perception. Mm-hmm. And that includes the role of sex in perception. So How does a work of art change when the audience knows that a man has made it or a woman has made it? I think that Harriet's argument that there is something called what she calls the masculine enhancement effect is in fact mostly true. It's certainly true in the art world. If you look at the numbers of solo shows by women as opposed to men, if you look at the prices of art paid for works of art made by men as opposed to women, all of this suggests that, in fact, it is advantageous to be a man making art in the contemporary art world. I don't think there's any question about that. However, the book is not simply a feminist parable, because Harry's alarm about all of this, which is in some way justified, is also coming out of her own personal life story, her anxieties about her father, the fact that I think she did not assert herself in terms of her art in the way she might have. So it's a complicated world that one enters when one enters the book. It is not simple or reductive.
Meaning that there are those moments where you feel culpable for what has happened, that you can't blame society, you can't blame outside forces for what is happening. You have to take responsibility.
Yes, although, you know, we are all the products of our culture as well. We're the products of language and culture, and we are all, I think, prone to unconscious biases, including sexual bias. So it goes on and on. In other words, it's very difficult to come down in any single place. And what I hope is that the individuals, some of them are more appealing than others, I agree, in the book, but that each one of them, in a way, has a part of the truth, that the novel is telling a very complicated and, I think, highly emotional story about a woman who is desperate for recognition. This is an unusual story. You know, still, many stories about women are not about their ambition. So we have, I think, a figure of female genius at the center of this book. And she is not looking for love. She is looking for recognition from the world.
I do want to talk about that element of genius in a moment. I want to go back to something you were talking about in the art world. And it's something that is a charge that has been leveled against literature as well by female authors, best-selling female writers who have said, look, there are more men who get reviewed in the New York Times. When you look at a show like the very show you're on and you look at the number of women versus men, it's more men than women, although women are publishing more books. And it's an interesting statistic when you think that it's somewhat universal across the arts.
Yes. Well, it is interesting. I have a theory that there are certain parts of our culture that we regard as feminine anyway. The arts and the humanities have a feminine connotation to begin with in our culture. The sciences have a hard and much more masculine connotation. Hence, if a woman is writing a novel, she is in some sense doubly feminized. Whereas if she's doing neuroscience, something that I'm deeply interested in and have lectured about, she is masculinized by the fact that she's doing hard science. A man is doubly masculinized if he's a neuroscientist pursuing that discipline. So we divide the world into masculine and feminine forms so that in the arts, there is an enhancement effect by creating, by having a man doing something that's possibly a little bit alarmingly feminine. This goes to, of course, readers of novels. Women read far more novels than men, And if men read novels, they generally do not like to read novels written by women. So, of course, there are exceptions to this rule, many exceptions. And I do not think most of this is conscious. I do not think most of this is malicious in our world. Now, there is malicious sexism out there, but that is not what we're talking about here. Mm-hmm. I think these are very much hidden biases. They're connected to very old divisions in the culture between mind and body, the mind being masculine and the body being feminine. That the idea of the cerebral woman, the genius, if you will, is something that the culture still has a rather hard time accepting.
I would like you to read a short passage from the beginning of the book, and this is a section where the character talks about leaving the feminine behind.
There are many stories and as many reasons for leaving the feminine behind and adopting the masculine, or dropping either one for the other, as was convenient. There were women who followed their husbands to war and fought to be near them, and women who fought purely from patriotic fervor and, after the battle, returned to being women. There were women who posed as men to inherit their father's fortunes, and women who had lost everything, husbands and children and money, who felt too vulnerable to go on as women and turned themselves into men. Many of them had sympathetic mothers and fathers and siblings and friends who kept their secret. Some garments, a name, a differently inflected voice, and the gestures to go with them were all that was required. After a time, being a man became effortless. Moreover, it became real.
The new novel is The Blazing World by Siri Husvet, and it is published by Simon & Schuster, and Siri is our guest on The Book Show this week. When you think about that idea of leaving the feminine behind, becoming, putting that mask on and presenting the art in this new light, what is fascinating is, A, how it is received, and then ultimately what happens when it is revealed that the art has been created by a woman.
That's right. So the three men that Harriet uses are very different people. The first one is a young, fairly ignorant artist who knows actually very little about art, and she makes a piece for him, and he does very well. He's a young white boy. The second is a black gay friend of Harry's, who's a performance artist, who poses for her. And of course, the work is received very differently because he's black and gay. So that those characteristics dominate the way the art is received, very much the way it can happen with women. And the final man mask is a highly successful artist. And there is great reluctance for anyone to believe that this obscure older woman could possibly have made this very ambitious work that's credited to him. So I wanted to have very different masks. And I think something that Simone de Beauvoir said long ago now, and The Second Sex remains true, and that is that the white man is a universal in a way that no woman, and certainly no black person or person of color, can be in our culture. I think it's changing. I don't think it's an intractable problem, but I think it remains true that universality is white and male.
As I mentioned, I wanted to talk to you about the aspect of genius, which when you think of what this artist is able to do with those three masks, to create that and to create the art from that perspective speaks to that genius.
Yes. In other words, that she becomes altered depending on what mask she has taken on. This is very important. And it comes out of my obsessive reading of the Danish philosopher Søren Kierkegaard, who wrote a number of texts under pseudonyms. And those pseudonymous texts do not necessarily represent Kierkegaard's own views. He really took on whole other personas. And Harry, my heroine, is a great reader of Kierkegaard and a great reader of many other things as well. So she reads science and neurology and philosophy, and all of that is part of the book. The conceit is that it's introduced by a scholar who has collected the texts in the book after Harry is dead. We know that from the very beginning of the novel. And that this is her legacy, in a way. The book is her legacy.
And at the point that it is realized, there becomes that shocking moment, because there is a controversy over what is real and what is not.
Yes.
Of believing the story.
Yes.
Which is interesting in and of itself, what we choose to believe, what we choose not to believe.
That's right. And the context is hugely important. I think we like to feel that we are unbiased, that we make up our own minds about works of art, but about many other things in the world as well. In fact, I think we, all of us, are subject to biases, often ones that we are not aware of. And to some degree, this book is an exploration of all of that happens in perception. And in some way, I hope that some readers are thrown back on themselves, as it were, because the answers are not simple, not clear.
The idea of creativity and how we express that creativity is fascinating, and yet you look at it in a way of how that creativity is accepted by others, and ultimately how important for some the backstory is of understanding how that particular work of art is created.
Yes. Well, the truth is that my character dies before she receives the recognition that she very much wanted. At the same time, Harriet Burton is a character who continues to make art. At one point, her lover Bruno says, you know, she's popping works of art out of her like, you know, wet, bloody newborns. And so that creative urge is present throughout the book in her work. She never stops. And in that sense, she does not give up. She's enraged. And I have to say that writing as an enraged character was very interesting. It was not depressing to me. The kind of rage that Harriet has is focused and invigorating in some way. She also has a lot of fun with wordplay and verbal games. So it was a great pleasure being this outsized, enraged, very big woman. I had a lot of fun.
Do you find rage easy in the sense of tapping it?
Well, yeah, I think you have to find those places inside yourself. I mean, I've often said, you know, even when books have nothing to do with one's literal autobiography, what one has to find is something in the text that answers an emotional truth. I think the reason that fictions, after all, these people are not real people in our lives, they're fictional people, the reason that fiction can have such force in the lives of human beings is because it's answering some emotional truth in all of us. We are able to recognize an aspect of ourselves in a character or in a story that resonates as true. In that way, I do not think that novels are lies. I think novels have to be about truth, or they're not worth writing or reading.
I want to get back to something we were just talking about when you were saying that this art is just popping out of her, and which is quite an image. But when you think of the of how we accept it as an audience and just art in general, that backstory of does it matter that it is coming from someone who is Black and gay or an older man, or that story has fuels and informs how we receive that art.
Absolutely. And of course, it may well be that it's impossible not to inform the art in some way. The autobiographies of famous artists are of great interest to people. So autobiographies and biographies. But at the same time, I think that it can weigh too heavily on the work of art. We like young heroes. I think this is something the culture has cultivated, and that we should be at least aware of how these contextual considerations influence the way a work of art is read. After a while, of course, it has a tendency to go away. You know, no critic praised Wuthering Heights, one of, I think, the greatest English novels, period. It was simply too complex. Now it's a classic. They praise Jane Eyre, however. I think it's a simpler novel. The great, meaty, diabolical, amoral Wuthering Heights did not get the attention that it deserved. Now, the fact that it was written by a young woman who is dead at 30 may have had something to do with it as well. We're not sure. You can't always explain these things. But nevertheless, it's good to enter the world of a book, to open yourself to the world of a book, and live in it for the time that you do live inside it. I like to say it's, I mean it, but it's also comic, that art is like sex. If you don't relax, you won't enjoy it. I really mean it, you know? It's opening yourself up to the experience of the book itself. It's coming in without prejudice to the degree that that's possible.
With that said, and I ask this question seriously, did you ever consider yourself as a writer wearing a mask and delivering this book under a pseudonym, a male pseudonym?
Yes, I did. I have. I think it's because one realizes that that books do get different receptions. I was rather interested in the media story of J.R. Rowling's entrance into detective fiction that she published under an obscure male name, and it did not sell very many copies, although I think it was critically praised. And once people understood that it was this, you know, mega writer, the book began to sell millions of copies. So there's a great little parable about the culture. Now it happens that this is a woman, a very, very famous woman writer. But her fame, of course, contextualizes the pseudonymous book.
Right.
So it's interesting. I mean, I think these are great. I'm interested in hoaxes of various kinds, and there are some hoaxes mentioned in the book, both literary and artistic.
When you think about the fact that you have written an awful lot about the art world, and we started this conversation by talking about your interest in the visual, will you continue to write about it?
I think I will write about works of art until I die. I most recently did an essay on Anselm Kiefer, the German artist, and before that I wrote a catalog essay on a great show that was in Germany on Picasso, Beckmann, and de Kooning, actually all portraits of women. That's part of my fascination, is to continue to write about works of art. It gives me great pleasure.
Sari Husvedt's new novel is The Blazing World. It is published by Simon & Schuster. Sari, thank you so much for joining us this week.
It was a great pleasure. Thank you.
We enjoy hearing from our listeners about the show. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. This show was recorded at Argo Studios in New York City. My thanks to them. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.